a podcast from the British Postal Museum and Archive.
And there was a little bit of letter writing along the way. I think there's probably a sort of more broader case of communication that was happening, and whether that was showing up as a Westerner and a white person with a bicycle in the middle of China or in the deep south of the United States. The way that communication has maybe changed in terms of keeping in touch with the outside world when you're on your own in a desert with only a bicycle and with nothing to charge your phone or this, that and the other. So it's communication in the broadest sense. Also, for the most part, I like to see it as a bit of a story. The book came out just last year, a year ago this week actually. And so that's why I'm revisiting an experience that happened, as was said, in 2009. And yeah, sometimes it's a little bit strange going back in time almost to the mindset that I had as a 23-year-old when I was planning this ride and a 24-year-old riding it. But the story really begins in the Midlands, with me as a young lad growing up. And always, as is the case with many young lads, really enjoying my bicycle. I think, and increasingly the more I do talks like this, people associate adventure and myself with going into international places, travelling unsupported. But actually my first adventure, for the most part, I see as myself being a 10-year-old lad, bored on a Saturday afternoon in March, April, drizzly, and asking my mum if I could ride to my grandparents' house, which was about 10 miles away. And I remain very grateful to my mum for saying yes to that and having enough faith in me to have remembered the sort of 10 miles, but only about half a dozen turnings between the two villages that I'd have needed to take. We ran through the directions, she felt I had them, and off I went. And about 40 minutes later, I'd arrived at my grandparents' house, much to their surprise, because I wasn't with my mum. And I think that remains something that I really find very special about the bicycle, and the sort of value it can have on the lives of young people in particular, that you have your first independence and your first freedom. You don't necessarily have to rely on your parents to take you somewhere. And I remember showing off at my grandparents' house that day and having conversations about my parents and about my parents' relationship and all of these conversations that you don't have when your parents are around. So it was in some ways this sort of first kind of adulthood. And increasingly I've done work with youngsters in London who absolutely love their bicycles, and in a city that can be very restrictive, especially when you're a young person, it really offers them a sense of sort of opportunity and escape. Myself, growing up in the Midlands, it wasn't at all like London, there wasn't as much going on. It's the sort of town that is increasingly kind of negatively typified as being post-industrial decline, and the motor trade that was there is no longer there. The hosiery factories have all closed down. Unfortunately, there are about three motorways running through the area, so there's lots of drug trafficking that goes through, and a lot of people that I knew fell into drugs, gangs and violence. And so the bicycle, again, I didn't think of it in these terms at the time. It was just an exciting way of getting myself to somewhere more interesting than the place that was around me. I think as well, and it sounds a little bit tenuous, but actually for me, bicycles and stories have always been very well linked. I always liked reading as well, and as I came to learn more as a teenager about cycling and professional cycling and some of the stories that came with it, I became more and more captivated by the bicycle and by the sport of it, and I sort of fell in love with the idea of becoming a professional cyclist, which transpires I never would have been anywhere near good enough to be even the last place finisher in something like the Tour de France. But the stories that come from a race such as the Tour, which back in the early 19th century was started by a newspaper editor concocting this brilliant bicycle race that had no individual stages. It was just starting and stopping, finishing at the same spot. And the riders that could stay awake longest and continue to pedal throughout the nights were likely going to be the ones that would win. With these passes in the Pyrenees and the Alps that they were going to be sent over en route. And whereas now we're in an age very much of professional athletes and support, at the time it was sort of potters and lumberjacks and blacksmiths setting out to win some sort of fame and hopefully some fortune for doing well in this bicycle race that was created to boost flagging circulations, really. And you've got the stories, well, rampant cheating in particular is one of the most entertaining parts of it, and you'd have the identical twin brothers who were disqualified when it was discovered that they were racing as one rider. You've got the first winner of the tour who was disqualified when it transpired that he'd caught a train at one point. You've got the fantastical enough that it's scarcely believable, but the stories of riders with wine corks clenched in their teeth and cheese wires fed around the wine cork and to the wing mirror of a car that would have been pulling them along. And then my all-time, and it's becoming an increasingly well-known story, but my favourite one is the blacksmith who had had a crash, had his front forks of his bicycle break. He repaired his front forks with a branch from a tree, made a splint and pedalled on to the next town, where being a blacksmith he went straight to the forge and repaired the forks properly, but was disqualified because someone else had pumped the bellows for him. So all of these stories that came from the tour, you know, the respect for the yellow jersey, the sort of half tradition of the riders that have slept in it the first time they've ever won it at the end of a stage, really captivated me. And so, yeah, cycling and stories became sort of knitted together for me from quite an early age. Throughout my teenage years, doing more and more riding, at the end of my teens, just starting at university, I rode to Istanbul. Actually, that was when I was 20. 19 to Lisbon, 20 I rode to Istanbul. And having previously ridden out of a county in the Midlands to Warwickshire, to the neighbouring counties, to realise actually with only about a week and a bit to Lisbon and about 4 weeks to Istanbul, I could cross an entire continent and be at the end of a map that I'd started on one side of and got to the far side of, just became truly, truly spellbinding as an experience, and the sense of possibility that kind of opens up, that just with this very simple invention and your own legs, you can set out from, well, yeah, from the UK and reach the Black Sea after 4 weeks of pedalling. I suppose it did that thing that bicycles can do to people of always wanting to go further, and eventually that came to be going all the way around the world. But going around the world and the world record that I set for doing so is really in some ways quite at odds with the experiences of cycling as I've always had them. And for the most part, far and away, the most important part of the rides I've done is generally the humanity that it brings you into touch with when you're crossing a country just on a bicycle. And there's something about the immediacy of travelling by bicycle, where you don't have the metal of the car or the windshield that makes everything the other side of it look almost like a television image. You're actually thrust straight into the culture, for good or bad, that you're passing through, which in a car you can drive through, and in a plane you can fly right over sort of that tens of thousands of years of civilization in a couple of hours. And the other thing about a bicycle is it's very humble, and whether it's the US border guards US-Canadian border guards who laugh at you when you say you're going to cycle to Mexico, or whether it's the peasants and the farmers in Kazakhstan who are just quite charmed by the fact that you've shown up on a bicycle, people find it somehow disarming, whether it's because the nature of the bicycle assumes some sort of innocence, or a time when they were children and rode their own bicycles. I've always had an incredible amount of generosity bestowed upon me as a cyclist travelling through. That might be in Turkey, for example, and buying a simit, which I don't know if anyone who's been to Turkey might know, but it's like a pretzel covered in sesame seeds. Going into a baker's and buying one with the friend that I cycled to Istanbul with that first time, and we're outside eating our simit, and then the baker's little helper comes out with a bag of two extra simits for us in it. Being in Romania was always one that stands out. And in the south of Romania, by the Danube River, which is very poor, and the food is really not so good. And showing up in a small town at the end of a day's cycling, and having a border guard from a nearby border crossing see these two cyclists appear, and taking it upon himself to find us the coldest beers, sending his son off to get us a bag of tomatoes, some cheeses and some peeled cucumbers, and then sitting us down in the restaurant to have this really not bad meal in the context of Romania. And then at the end sending us on our way without any hearing a word of money or payment. And that really was the typical sort of experience that I've had. And I've had broken wheels in the United States where people have paid for the wheel to be repaired. I've had couples that I've bumped into in grocery stores while I was counting my not quite as much as I'd have liked money in my wallet, and they've given me $20, having heard that I was cycling around the world, and so buy dinner on us. And so the sort of experience that the generosity that I've experienced on the road has always been profoundly humbling, which is why I ended up breaking the world record in some ways, because I was in Istanbul having cycled there for the second time. This would have been 2008. And I met a couple who were slowly cycling their way around the world, having quit jobs in London and set off first for Australia. And I think in the end they rode for about 4 years going round and round. And they mentioned a chap who was in the process of breaking the world record then at about 100 miles a day. And that was a curious sort of idea. And I'd always ridden to Istanbul at maybe about 70 miles a day. Wouldn't really have thought why someone might be interested in doing it faster. And I looked into his website and what he was doing, and I really just took a very instant dislike to everything about the way that he'd set about it. And he was sponsored by hotel groups and by telephone companies and by an investment fund and by a bank that the taxpayer just bailed out. And all of these very sort of down-to-earth, humane experiences of cycling were still there, you know. You still had the open road, you still had the sunset, you still had the images of the poor people sharing their food. But at the same time with a big investment fund and a bank attached to it. And there was something to me that was just profoundly dishonest about using these experiences just as part of a marketing strategy, almost. So I took a disliking to it, and it stayed there in the back of my mind. He carried on with his 100 miles a day, ended up setting a record at, I think, 90 miles a day average. And then I think the documentary that came out of that sort of made me even more irritable, because as media often has a tendency to do, it had shown all that was bad about it. It shows, you know, the mugging, it shows the car accident, it shows the feeling sick, and all of the humanity of actually the freedom of travelling with your bicycle and your tent packed up over your back wheel. None of that was kind of stripped away, and it had made what had always seemed very down to earth and fun look very difficult, alpha male, and not particularly enjoyable. I was working at that point in London as a bicycle messenger, where you rack up about 60 or 70 miles a day just delivering things around London anyway. I was getting increasingly irritable about London and modern society. I've sort of learned to tune out of that a little bit, but going along Oxford Street and you see the bags that say happiness is a shopping bag, or the billboard that was doing the rounds at the time for the Mini, the new Mini, which was this sort of southwestern Arizona, New Mexico landscape, and the Mini at the front of it with Mini, the new adventure. The best one was Ewan McGregor, the actor, who'd just been around the world on a motorbike with a film crew and a security crew and the chef, but nonetheless selling this same very inaccessible hal and back and ultra male vision of what it is to travel, and not at all down to earth. And that's something else I'd say for the bicycle, that people around the world associate it with someone who doesn't have much money. So when you show up with sort of £20,000 worth of BMW motorbike engine revving, I think the way that the local people will inevitably react to you is fundamentally different to when you roll in on your bicycle looking exhausted and put it on its stand. And Ewan McGregor had teamed up with the perfume manufacturer Davidoff and released a fragrance called Adventure, which was most ridiculous, because adventure in my experience isn't the best smelling of things at all. And at this kind of loose end and irritated, all of these kind of consumer experiences of capitalism, where, you know, we're offered the opportunity to buy something as an inroad into an experience that we don't have ourselves because we're carrying on going to work or what have you, and seeing things like the Gandhi quotes, be the change you want to see in the world, around skyscrapers being built around Leadenhall Street. I thought, yeah, you know, I can do 100 miles a day. And so I teamed up with the New Economics Foundation and the Tax Justice Network, trying to sort of create this statement that it didn't just have to be investment funds and their ambassadors that could do this, this adventurous, pioneering undertaking. And I set out. The route started in Normandy, and I rode then 8,000 miles to Shanghai through Central Asia. I flew from Shanghai down to Bangkok and cycled 1,000 or 2,000 miles to Singapore, flew to the south of New Zealand and rode to the north in Auckland. From there I got a flight to Vancouver and cycled the Pacific coast to Tijuana, along the bottom of the United States, then to Jacksonville, Florida, and then up the Atlantic coast to Boston before flying back to Lisbon and then to my start line in Normandy. And the numbers of the ride, which I just do in this sort of potted form, officially the count on the ride is 169 days for the record that I set when I returned. It was 18,049 miles. The criteria for a certain navigation is to do 18,000. I lived on about an average 10 euros a day, which would vary between maybe 30 bucks or what have you in the United States, where I was paying people to make me food because I was in a rush and things are just more expensive. Whereas when you're in the middle of the Kazakh steppe, you'd be lucky to spend 2 euros in a day, even if you were trying. The average daily distance was 110 miles, which sounds more than it is, and actually when you get into this rhythm of waking up early in the morning, because you're not even sleeping in a tent, especially when you're in a desert, because it's not going to rain, and so there are pretty good stars out there. So, 110 a day, that might have been plains of Texas, with cotton fields all around and it's completely flat and the tailwind is coming off the Pacific and all you have to do is sort of make your shoulders big and you get pushed along at 35 miles an hour just by the Pacific, and that day would have been 235 miles that I managed, or when I first arrived at the United States absolutely spellbound by the enormity of it all and was just talking to people about God and gun laws and abortions, I was only managing about 50 miles a day. So yeah, very much a product of averages and ups and downs. I mean communication, there's I find so many fascinating little details in there that it's nice to have an opportunity to think about them a little bit more and talk about them here. It was really interesting as I went. It was very sort of, it was almost like one-way glass that you have when you're being maybe interrogating a witness or whatever at the police station, in that communication technology as it was then meant that everyone in the UK sort of watching on the website could see me. I had a GPS tracker that I would press a button on and it sent a message to a satellite, and that created a map that people could see on the website, so they could see where I was and I could press a button if I had an emergency. But I had no idea of my context on the map in the way that the people watching at home, and I've definitely spoken to some people in offices that got quite addicted to checking my progress, because it was updating every 20 kilometres. And the day that I did manage 235 miles through Texas, I think I got a few messages coming in saying, have you just ridden 235 miles? But the other thing that I was using then was Twitter in its very earliest days, when, and certainly before the time of smartphones. So I was just sending an SMS text message to this newfangled website, which obviously went on to do quite well, and people could see what I was saying, you know, a little anecdote for the day. And that was another thing about it. It was one, I sent one tweet every day because it was quite expensive to send a text message from China, and because I suppose we didn't even have necessarily the same culture of updating your status sort of 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 or endless times in a day. It was also interesting as well that the GPS tracker that Guinness wanted for verification was an option at that point in 2009, whereas now it's mandatory because, again, I see the availability of GPS and the assumption of tracking. I mean, I had the record verified with that tracking feed, and now the couriers that are delivering things in London, it's fairly commonplace that they too will be tracked, and so there's an assumption that has become a norm. I think in amongst that, and not necessarily being in touch with people directly, it was very rare that I would get a text message, and occasionally I'd stop in an internet cafe and see emails. Writing really became a very close friend to me because, as it always has been, it's always gone hand in hand with all of my travelling, especially in hot countries where there are about 3 or 4 hours in the middle of the day where you're not going to be riding anyway because it's too hot. I'd always be sitting down in a cafe and I'd be collecting my thoughts. I'll be riding along thinking about a nice bit of imagery or the way that a certain word sounds. And also there's your sort of lived reality of your day-to-day on the bicycle, but then you end up taking on a slightly different existence on the pages that you're recording. And that story becomes one that is broadly the same as what actually happens, but almost the act of recording it gives you a sort of perspective that sometimes makes the difficult stuff seem a little bit easier. And a bit more manageable, because it's just appearing there as words on a page and you're ordering your thoughts, which is really a helpful process when I think you are on your own in far-flung places. I mean, it's very interesting, the book itself. I think, let's see, the first, maybe the first third of the book or so is about the first half of the mileage. And I noticed this in editing it, that the latter stage for the United States in particular is actually much longer as a book, and the main reason for that is because there's dialogue, because I was actually having proper communication with people and conversation, and there's very little dialogue in the first part of the book. And as sort of a bit of a fantasist who had always absolutely dreamed of going through Central Asia, I'm half Turkish, and Turkish overlaps really fantastically well with the Kazakh language. Going back to the days of sort of Genghis Khan and the Mongols, being able to talk to people in the middle of the steppe when they came out of their yurt was just a fascinating adventure. So the first part of the book, with those very basic communications, there's a lot of fantasy going on. I'm feeling like this young person setting out against the world. Come the United States, there's probably more advanced reflections on the world around me going on. One of the other things that I find very interesting about cycling and travel in particular is the way that sort of romance and travel are sort of inherently linked, because the sense of what we expect in terms of how fast we feel we should be able to get from our A to our B, or the speed of communication with which we can have ourselves put at ease, or we can hear word that we're waiting on, is very much related to distance. And of course the distance on a bicycle moving at 12 miles an hour is still very much a human distance, there's something about that speed of travel which I've always found to be one of the nicest things about travelling by bike. It gives you this fantastic opportunity to see the cultures and the people that you're passing through. But at the same time, it's fast enough that I got to Shanghai in 83 days. And I always remain sort of pretty excited at the fact that just with a bicycle I got to the sort of the Yellow Sea of eastern China within 3 months. And this point that I'm making as well, actually, is sort of brought out better by one of my favourite little anecdotes about Flaubert, Gustave Flaubert, who's one of my favourite writers. But Madame Bovary, which was his debut, really, and certainly the book that made his name, was published, I think, in 1857, but is actually set in somewhere around about 1852. Because what had happened in that 5 year period was that the railways, which Flaubert hated, I think I mentioned that in the book, had been invented and had come about. So what previously had been a 1 day carriage ride from Rouen, where a lot of the action is, to the village where the story takes place, was suddenly manageable in a very short amount of time. And Flaubert felt that completely ruined the possibility for building anticipation and the sense of unknowing. And so that's really what I mean when I say that I feel that travel and romance are inherently linked. And again, yeah, the sort of human scale of crossing a continent on a bicycle as compared with the ability that we now have, which is phenomenal, to fly to the United States in 5 or 6 hours, or to fly to Shanghai in, I don't know, maybe 10. There's just a couple of moments from Life Cycles that I was going to read. They were particular moments where I feel this fantasy friend of me and my writing that I'd be scribbling into my notepads really came out. So the first is from Kazakhstan, reflecting on whether or not Kazakhstan was technically a desert or not. Staffs of stone were rooted in the earth along the road. painted markers counting off each kilometre. I deliberated, pondering whether this truly was a desert I cycled through. And then, one afternoon, a horse emerged upon the horizon, an odd-shaped creature of peculiar proportions. The silhouette grew a mound on its back, then a hump, and then, lo, it was not a horse at all, but in fact a camel. I stopped in amazement, for camels lived in deserts, and if this was a camel, then it must have been a desert through which I rode. The scale of it captivated me, the thought that I had left my house in London, taken a boat for 20 miles of the English Channel, began cycling, and then, by only the power of my legs, entered into a world where camels stalked the grasses, snarling back as I stood staring beside my bicycle. In Kazakhstan, I spent over 2,000 kilometres on a single road, with hardly a turning, a gallon of water carried over my back wheel, a pannier full of bread and jam, a head full of worst-case scenarios in which my bicycle broke down between settlements. The villages were 100 miles apart, and then 150, and eventually 200. Imagine London were only a village, Manchester another, and now imagine nothing in between upon that single road that joins them. You can see the towns in the distance. A single radio mast stands skinny against the horizon, comes slowly into view from 30 miles away. Kazakhstan is the ninth biggest country in the world, but with a population of just 16 million. I rode through some 3,000 miles of it, find it hard to believe that even that many people are living there. The land delighted in its endless scrub, and among those wastes I found myself smiling, simply smiling, for never have I been so at peace. The steppe was just a mirror, could comfortably represent either stark death or perfect simplicity, and each time, against that landscape so eternal, I realised all I saw was in fact only a measure of my own impatience or contentment. Out there I was humbled, so tenderly was I humbled, for I took with me all of my earthly weight, my cynicism, fear, ego and insecurity, and when we arrived in those wastelands, they saw the world in which they wished to live, so that very soon, all had fled from me. At dusk I watched settlements from afar, eating a small meal before disappearing back to the road. Trails went kicked up behind the goats, the horses and bulls being driven back inside the mud walls of the village. A bell would ring from a short tower, and I watched figures sitting lazy on horseback as they rounded up the herd, lines of dust making their way slowly back through the gate from different points on the landscape. Those sunsets in the Caucasus were something else, a tiny nightly supernova, like a hot ruby sinking to the bottom of a well. You could light a candle on them, smouldering in a pink that turned to blood. And I remembered that when I was sleeping in the deserts in Kazakhstan, I kind of always had this game whereby I would lie awake just looking at the sky until I saw a shooting star, and that was going to be the moment when I'd actually close my eyes and fall asleep. And in Kazakhstan, you'd never really have to wait more than 10 minutes for a shooting star to trail across. So it was a very special place. Central Asia was one place I'd really wanted to cycle in on the ride. The other really was the United States, and from listening to lots of Bob Dylan growing up and being really interested in blues music and folk music, not to mention Kerouac and the Beats, the United States was another place that I was really excited by the prospect of riding in, and never disappointed in any way. It's just the scale of it all, and be that the size of the redwoods or the fact that every village has a little sign underneath the name of the village saying in emergency 911, which really says something about the American obsession with danger and fear. And I do occasionally think just what it would be like if in the UK we had every village name with in emergency dial 999. And that's the negative side of it. There's a wonderful positive side to it as well, that the sort of sense of possibility that in a little grocery store in Oregon I would have walked in one Saturday morning getting myself a tub of ice cream before breakfast, which you can do when you're cycling around the world, have pre-breakfast ice cream. And the woman sort of takes my money and gives me back my change, and here's a little of what I'm doing, and she says, "Tell me, are you optimistic for the future of mankind?" This was at sort of 8:30 on a Saturday morning. That's the sort of question you can be asked in America. I'll just read a little bit from the Pacific Coast. So I had it there. Okay, yeah. As far as first impressions go, America punches you in the face. Signpost at a crossroads, small track intersects highway, two arrows pointing in different directions. Nursery school, that's on the top arrow. Beneath it on the second, shooting range. It was a lot of things before it was subtle. Money was everywhere, on every street. Bail bonds, 24 hours, a fast and friendly service. Then there were signs promising quick money for those who had to earn it all too slow. $700 cash advance on your wages. We cash checks, almost no commission. The automobile traders, signs on the forecourt. We welcome bankruptcies. Just drive in with the pickup you can no longer afford and they'll give you a morsel of cash in return for the asset that left you eyeballed in debt. Pawnbrokers roared at every corner. Trucks, gold, heirlooms, anything of value. They said that, barefaced, anything of value. And they'd take it from you in exchange for a pittance to keep you a go for one more week. The entire country was painted green. Billboards educating the population, offering counsel on how to spend the stack you hope to acquire. Big lifestyle? Skiing, hiking, mountain biking, friends, parties, kids, computers, jeeps? What you need is a big house. That was another thing, the size of it. With a nation the scale of a continent, there's no reason not to make everything proportionately huge. People twice the size they ought to be. Ice cream so tall you don't need to lift the cone. You should see the cups for all that carbonated sugar they're swigging all day long. And a standard aluminium drinks can resembles a thimble in an American hand. But stop me. I know how people take this sort of thing. They think I'm criticising, insulting. Those Americans are so accustomed to being slandered and done down, they get all defensive at the first sight of an outside observation, judgmental or not. The truth is, you can learn a lot more about a nation and its characteristics as a stranger looking around than as a citizen with everything right under your nose and entirely out of sight. And besides, I had no judgment, at least not then. On the Pacific coast, I was smitten. The United States had me besotted, out and out fairy-tailed. It was as if I'd set foot upon the centre of the universe, like I was living a dream, the dream. At last, and my God, so help me, but it was America. 20th century mythologies everywhere I turned. That waitress in the diner, apron gathered like a circus big top around her breasts and a gut full of comfort eating. She flashes her nicotine smile, the powder of her made-up face and the tattoo that reads, "Nobody's fool," on an arm handing turkey sandwiches over the counter. Pretty quick I fell in love with the trains there, with all those boxcars passing full of beatniks, songs and vagabonds. Double-decker boxcars, boxcars, boxcars went rattling by, and even as I rode one way and the train chugged the other. Still it took 2, 3, 4 minutes for the thing to pass. Trains are whole 3 miles long. On the back of those trains I saw the American economy, the budget deficit locked in freight containers that read Hyundai, Hanjin, Yangming, China Shipping, all moving east to west to countries that now sell services instead of goods. I remember it all, the mornings when I'd pull up outside a diner, walk on in, removing my jacket and placing it over the back of my chair as if sitting down to an office desk. Pancakes. I'd order pancakes with hot syrup, they'd dish them out, 3 at a time, scoop butter from a tub as if it were ice cream. 3 scoops, 1, 2, 3 scoops of butter melt into each pancake as you pour on your very own jug of hot syrup. Watch as it all turns golden and shines, the butter melting into tiny discs of fat. I'd eat it down, cleansing my palate with bottomless coffee, cups the waitress keeps refilling from the jug that spent 2 hours stewing in front of me. Bill settled, I'd pull my jacket back over my shoulders, tanked up to ride 1,000 miles of calories were all that mattered, a gut fit to burst and sugar coursing through me. Juddering, trembling, I stutter towards my bicycle and I get on, puffing and panting, feet turn slowly at the pedals, fingers and chin shaking, trembling, all trembling like the last leaves of summer that go on trembling from the branches. The leaves, wow, those leaves. I arrived at the beginning of autumn and the leaves gave meaning to words that had only ever sounded like artistry before. Magenta, vermilion. Suddenly magenta and vermilion had a meaning for me because the leaves, they were magenta, they were vermilion, painted in tempera and just tipped with green, brushed at the top. My God, but they were beautiful. And sometimes there was one green leaf that was left amongst the red and it hung there, making that red all the more red, just waiting in defiance of all that aged around it. So that was the Pacific. I went on into the deserts of Mexico and then New Mexico and carried on to the Atlantic and rode up the coast of Boston. As much as you can ride 110 miles a day fairly steadily, so long as you're keeping to a decent rhythm. Come the end, I would have been riding 150 to 200 miles every day, which is definitely a lot harder, and sort of sleeping maybe 3 hours where I could grab it. And there's maybe the writing changes again, because when you're sleeping only 3 hours and trying to ride 150 miles and the summer's way behind and winter's coming, it's not quite so easy. And yeah, it was there was a little bit of surrealism that creeps into it towards the end, perhaps, from the sleep deprivation in particular. I mean, I finish a talk generally with a reading that's actually the start of the book. And yeah, as much as there were parts of the ride that were difficult, I always say, and it's entirely true, that the hardest part was coming back to London. And for all my efforts, I hadn't quite managed to make Britain a sort of centre-left social democracy within my 6 months of cycling process. But I was right to try. But yeah, so yeah, I'll just read the beginning of the book from here. I shot my mouth off, still sleep-deprived and shaken. Within a fortnight of return, I told everyone exactly what I thought of the previous record holder. Then, more than ever, I couldn't believe how he'd sold it all away. The beauty of the open road, the warmth of humankind, the way he'd slapped a logo on it and sold the whole shebang to whichever bank would pay most. The mild-mannered folk of the cycling community told me I had it wrong, and they reminded me delicately that he'd done it for charity. That was how I earned myself the moniker of Angry Young Man, and they put it my way as some sort of insult, while all the time I racked my brains as to how it was that I was the only one so angry. I returned to the same job, to the same life as before, and with visions of the Gobi Desert's outward reaches still blowing through my mind, I went back to picking my way through the potholes and gnarling traffic of London. I thought of all those who had taken me in, Lemoyne's in Louisiana, Ray over on South Island. I tried to piece the world back together, to make sense of the CCTV cameras, the apparently suspicious packages, the strangers who were, just maybe, standing too close to me at the cash point. I tried to make sense of it all, and then slowly I stopped trying, because the sad truth was it didn't make sense. We'd just chosen to live that way. London swallowed me back. I watched diggers with their caterpillar tracks crawling over rubble, destructive ballerinas with pirouetting scoops that tore down flats, the same as I'd once watched them do in Xi'an, China, so that I wondered what they did with those who'd once lived there. The deliveries made on my bicycle were all the same, still going to the same offices, the same receptionists scribbling their names impatiently on an electronic screen. One day I turned up at an architectural practice to collect a package going down to an international depot on the Old Kent Road. They handed me a long cardboard tube containing the plans for another structure in glass and steel on the other side of the world. I looked down at the tube in my hand, curious about its final destination, and there it was. Pudong, Shanghai. Inside of me something heaved. My poor heart gave a lurch, for I'd cycled there, to the airport in Pudong itself, 83 days if I remembered rightly. There I was, back in London, my old job, my old bicycle leaning on a wall. I slid the tube into my bag with a sigh, climbed onto my bike and pedalled off. Making my way through the traffic, I watched the chain rumbling below, clinging to the teeth of the cog as they heaved it round, wheels turning and the asphalt moving below. Knees up and down, everything just as before. That same scene I'd taken in over so many countless hours on my way around the world. And if you've got any questions, and thank you very much for being a kind audience.
For more information on this podcast, please visit postalheritage.org.uk/podcast.